So the others will speak tonight, Terry, where's Terry?
Yeah.
There you go. And Pramesh, again, thank you both for being here. And with that, I'll hand you over to Terry.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Josh, and hi, everybody. I'm Terry Coven, and I'm editor and partner of Brandon Wilson, as you know, at Hopeful Books in Johannesburg. Welcome, and thank you all for coming from Hopeful Books. And I want to also say to Kim that it's completely wonderful to be at this moment in relation to Kim's book. It's been a complete pleasure working with Kim on August House's Dead, Long Live August House. I know many of you are her friends and colleagues, and to work with Kim is to work with an extremely organized and gracious and interesting person who came to us with an extremely well-conceptualized and organized manuscript, a fantastic Dropbox folder. I mean, these are dreamy things when you work with people on books. And those of you who know for books, we work, our books combine, we're steering more and more toward books that are at the intersection between art and literature. And Kim's been quite self-conscious as we worked with this manuscript that this was different from her more academic work. She was working on this at the same time as she was submitting a PhD, and often made the distinction between this being narrative nonfiction or creative nonfiction by contrast with her more academic work. And at times it was a difficult tension for her in this book, and we had to persuade her to be comfortable with the mode of writing that she'd adopted for this book. And, first of all, we pay very careful attention to the relationship between words and images. We pay very careful attention to the three-dimensional object that eventually lands up in your hand. And so too did Kim. She presented us with a book that she had conceptualized pretty much as the building that August House is. It was a book that went this way, it went that way, it went in many dimensions. And it was a very, very interesting editorial and design challenge. Our designer's not here, Carla Saunders. She designed the last four or five of Hoffmann's books since Oliver Barstow left for Amsterdam. And she did the most extraordinary job. So I want to just say again that it's been a wonderful project to work on. We're extremely proud of the book that we've landed up with, and we wish Kim and the book very well into the world. And as many of you know, Publishing is a very difficult business to be in. There's very little money in it, and we depend enormously upon funders, and we depend upon others in order to make these books possible and to bring them into the world. And in this instance, we were very generously funded by the GCRO, and I'm sure Kim and Edgar will mention in more detail who the Gauteng City Regional Observatory are. But they're a research unit in Johannesburg, and between them and Ekaplus's African Centre for Cities in Cape Town, we were able to produce this really beautiful book. So I want to thank the funders, I want to thank Kim Gurney, and I want to thank my partner Brandon Wilson-Yun. It's been a pleasure to work with you all. And yeah, that's it.
Thanks, Terry. And I will play ping pong with Josh. The self-effacing host that he is, forgot to say something about the exhibition on the first floor. And we were very pleased that we could have the launch here, because there's such a profound connection between this text and what is going on in this program. So Josh, if you could just say a few short words on that text.
The exhibition upstairs is directed by Zipo Dayini and Mangwa Lule. It's called You and I, and it's a meditation of a kind, or a set of provocations or opportunities to think about collectivity. By that we mean how people come together, what motivates groups to form, and opposites, what motivates systems to kind of fracture, or the individual to hold space in relation to a group. And they've assembled a really interesting array of pieces, some from the collection of the benefactor of this space, some from Museum, the Studio Museum in Harlem, at least one piece, a fantastic piece by Yoko Ono from a collection in Vancouver. And effectively, I've created a strange environment where ideas seem to push in different directions and encourage some thinking about what it means to be oneself and what it means to be in relation to others. And it was a project that was kickstarted by Kimon some time ago when he was a student, something I'd heard about, something he was keen on investigating, brought Zippo into that process, and it really mutated quite wonderfully. And for us at A4, where we really believe that the capacity for us to do our work relates to our capacity to work with other organizations and other individuals to kind of build a network and to really kind of bolster the ecosystem widely, it was a fantastic opportunity to reflect on who we are and reflect on what we want to do through an exhibition of this kind. So I really encourage you to pop upstairs and waltz through there when you have a chance.
Thanks, Josh. So that space has been kept open for our purpose, so please feel free to enjoy it. And we're also very fortunate that there's Natalie, that Hoghouse and Carlos at the back there are plying us with fantastic craft beer and wine. So you will be in absolutely the right frame of mind to appreciate Yoko Ono. I promise you, you need it. Otherwise, it will be a challenge. So I'm Edgar Peterson, and I work at the African Centre for Cities, and I'm absolutely delighted that you're all here on a Friday night, and that we're also in a specific space because we're building a really fantastic partnership with A4 Arts Foundation. And most importantly, that we have another opportunity to celebrate the remarkable contribution of Kim Gurney to both the intellectual life but also the scholarly output of ACC. So I want to say a few things about ACC, and then I want to also channel my partner, Graham Gotts, based at the Gauteng City Regional Observatory, who can't be here tonight, and give a bit of context why we are so excited about this specific launch and generally the work of Kim. So the sort of first point to make is that our mandate at the African Centre for Cities as an interdisciplinary and interfaculty research hub for the University of Cape Town is to help the university and the city or society at large to understand the role that academic research can play, to both make sense of and respond to the immense complexity of the urban condition in South Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, and what we call in sort of academic jargon the global south. And these places are transforming without precedent. And academic knowledge is lagging very, very far behind in making sense of it. And what was very clear to us from the early days is that unless you bring a really strong and competent humanities perspective into this inquiry, you're going to miss the point and fail to come to terms with it. And so from the beginning, even though our mandate is to do quite applied work, we've been keen to court people like Kim and other colleagues in ACC who work in the humanities domain to help us understand what does urban culture mean? What is the role of contemporary art in both helping us understand, but also in, if you will, refracting the complexity of the urban? How do we bring historical perspectives? How do we bring questions of the social, of the spiritual, into both our methodological practice, but also our analytical frames? And by its very nature, this is virgin territory in a way, and we have very little resources to do this kind of work. So in that context, since 2011, we've had the privilege to work with Kim, where we had an opportunity to track a set of artistic interventions in the city of Johannesburg called New Imaginaries. And when I spoke to the Goethe Institute that sponsored that particular intervention, I realized that it doesn't occur to them that we need to build archives of these processes. We need to track the curatorial intent. We need to make sense of the relationship between artists and curators and the city, and of course people who practice, who engage in these practices as consumers, as participants, as citizens. And I guess I duped you a little bit, Kim, because the initial intent was to kind of do a really modest piece of kind of documenting this and so forth. And of course, Kim being Kim, you know, sort of went in there, what's the metaphor? Feet first, head first, I don't know, and got completely immersed. And very quickly it became apparent that she was actually writing a book, and it wasn't just going to be a research report on this process. And of course in 2015, her first book was published, which is, as far as I know, the only book-length academic treatment of contemporary public art practice in a southern city. And the book is somewhere there on the bookshelf behind the sheikh, for somebody there for you to browse. And so in that context, and also having collaborated with Kim in other capacities, we run a magazine called Cityscapes. And because Kim comes with multiple sort of capacities and training, she trained as a journalist, she trained as a fine artist, and has become an urbanist in the last couple of years, I guess. She has a remarkable facility to move between genres and registers. And so she's been one of our most prolific contributors to Cityscapes, and it's been a privilege to work with her in that capacity. And when she approached me to say, look, I've got this idea, I've got this project, I think there's something remarkable going on in downtown Johannesburg with this August House building, and there's a story to be told in a way that takes the artistic practice within the context of the studio, the atelier, on its own terms, as a way of helping us build a different narrative account of what the urban is. I obviously leapt at the opportunity. And so we joined Kim as collaborators. This is her initiative, it is her project, that's her vision. And we have felt really privileged, both GCRO and ourselves at ACC, to be able to partner with her in this project. And from the beginning, as Terry indicated, she had a very, very clear understanding that there's something about an artistic register that can help us account for and write the city differently. And when you read the book, and I think most of you have bought a copy, good on you.
Yeah, I think you have it, do you?
Exactly, Terry is still here. And it makes a fantastic gift. Christmas only 2 months away, so, you know. Just imagine the surprise, not socks this year. And so you will see that she's able to do something really remarkable, because the book has got a subtlety and a nuance to it, and it kind of draws you in this incredibly effective way. And you, before you know it, you're kind of rooting for different characters, you're rooting for a building, you're rooting for artworks, and all of a sudden you realize that actually, by the end of the book, my perception and my emotional relationship with probably one of the toughest cities in the world has profoundly shifted. And that's remarkable for someone to be able to achieve that with words. And of course, with a partnership with Fourth Wall Books, we found a great partner with them in respecting and understanding that artistic intent and being able to render that in a design language that does justice to the content of the book. And thank you for Fourth Wall for being open to that. And so just to say something on GCRO, because they were a generous contributor to the project, it's a technical, data-driven, computer nerds, GIS-obsessed bunch of people in the city of Johannesburg who does wonderful, wonderful work through large data sets to give us an understanding of contemporary Johannesburg in the larger Gauteng city region. And even though they are quantitatively oriented, they could see the value of this kind of fine-grained ethnographic artistic work. And I want to just, in their absence, acknowledge GCRO for that kind of visionary support, and particularly Graham Gotts for kind of batting for the project within the context of their own politics. And then I must just make sure I thank everyone. I think I've mentioned Hog House, who's, wow, that lager is remarkable. I don't want to forget anyone. I think I did. Yeah, just to again come back to April Arts Foundation. Where's Josh? This is a good plan. Yeah, just again, Josh, thank you so much. I mean, I think the poetic symmetry of being able to launch the book here, given the exhibition and given the vision of this project, couldn't have asked anything better. So, Josh, and Francis, everyone else involved in this project. And then finally, all that remains for me is to introduce our illustrious Cape Town academic. Premish Lalu has some dirt on me, and I have some on him, which I won't share tonight, but I am hoping to be bribed. Premish is an absolutely wonderful, brilliant, prolific, generous, and fantastic leader in the academic context of South Africa and in Cape Town. He's written one of the definitive accounts of one of the important episodes in the Xhosa history of Eastern Cape. He's one of the leaders internationally of one of the most important humanities academic networks in the world. And a month or two ago hosted their conference at the castle around the road and put out an incredible program. For the pointy heads in the room, people like Kwame Baba was there and all kinds of big names, and they clearly all thought he's a big deal, so and Premish and I were in undergrad together at UWC and in student struggles in the Cape Flats in the 80s, and it's been wonderful to reconnect this year through the integration syndicate upstairs, and I'm really, really pleased that you had time and that you were willing to share some reflections with us tonight. So you're more than welcome to address us. Thank you.
That's a lot of pressure. So I should start by saying that of late I've become particularly paranoid. And so when Edgar asked me to do this, I thought this was a bit of punishment for something I said a few years ago, and I regret saying this. I refer to people who do urban studies as in those who involve in the disciplines of the edifice complex. So I think that I kind of learned my lesson, so please forgive me. But thank you very, very much. And I want to start by saying that Kim Gurney has given us an absolute gift in this book. It's a beautifully crafted book. It's a very eloquent book. I read it over 2 days. Edgar dropped it over my wall. I don't have a post box. But it was an absolutely absorbing account of a set of questions that I think we're all wondering about. Is how does one account for the kinds of artistic practices that lie within the space of the itinerant? And how does one recall the kinds of affective shifts that are possible within the spaces of the itinerant. So I want to thank you very much for your effort and for your gift in this book. And I do want to encourage you to please buy this book. Buy two copies, one for Christmas as a gift and then one for yourself. I also want to say to Edgar, you know, this year has been phenomenal for me. Other than gallivanting the streets of the city, I have come to appreciate the discipline of the inquiry that you undertake at the African Centre for the Cities. And your commitment to the arts in this respect is very, very important. I think, you know, we often take for granted the ways in which the fissures of the university sometimes set us apart. But this has been an opportunity to think together, to think across a range of inquiries, and to think with a sense of purpose. So I want to say thank you to ACC, and then to Fourth Wall Books, which has, I mean, this is a beautifully made book. Please, I've got a book that I'm writing. I hope I can contact you at some point. I also have pictures. Some years ago, a dentist in Cairo by the name of Ala Aswani produced a book called The Yacoubian Building. Some of you might know this from the film made by Marwan Hamid with the same title, The Yacoubian Building. It's a somewhat tragic, somewhat uplifting film about the trials and tribulations of generations of people who lived in this building in the middle of Cairo that had been built by an Armenian millionaire in 1934. And that had seen various shifts and changes in the political landscape of Egypt and Cairo in particular. So that by the time of the coup, the Pasha, who occupies the space of the dandy, or what Benjamin might call the flaneur, in this space, is increasingly being displaced by militarists and hardened ideologues, people who come out of a very strong political sensibility and who want to ensure that the building gets transformed into a space that holds the officers and the military elite of Egypt. Now that book is a book about the fate of a building. It's an Art Deco building that was built, as I was saying, in 1934. But at the heart of the story that Ala Aswani presents us is this idea of the evisceration of the passions and desire that marked that space for so many decades and so many generations. And it is to that evisceration that I think Kim's book asks us to attend. She's asking us to think about what happens when the senses are put to rest, when they're killed off, when they're dead. What happens when we are only, when what we have available to us are hardened ideological positions in the world? What happened when affect has no place in the sensibilities that we operate in? And I think that Kim's book, in some sense, like the Yacoubian building, is an attempt to push us to think about history in a different key. And I want to suggest tonight that I think what Kim is asking us to do is to write a history not through the hardened sensibilities of ideology, but through aesthetics. To take the aesthetic as a serious grid through which to think the history of this country, to think the history not only of its past, but also the history of its present. And I think that what Kim has asked us to do very substantially in this book is to breathe life into a history that is increasingly being overwhelmed by a sense of death. And so, between the pink elephant to Gordon Trout's corn virus, we find a myriad of sensibilities, like in the Yacoubian building, different affective possibilities, different loves, different desires, different passions, different conflicts. But all of those combined within a sensibility about what is possible in an ever-increasing situation and condition of violence and warfare. And so I want to select three, you know, of those moments that I thought in the book were very, very powerful indicators of what it might mean to think history through the arts. The first of those is an event that I recall very vividly. It was the killing of Gito Baloyi And it's the killing of Dieter Baloy in Nugget Street, if I'm not mistaken. I recall this event so vividly, because not only was Kananath an iconic feature of the landscape of political activism in the 1980s that Edgar and I and so many others were involved in. In fact, provided us with the signature tunes and sense of music in that period. But that the death of Dieter Baloy marked a very difficult period in the kind of musical history in this country. And what I found intriguing in this book was the reminder of not only what led to Dieter Baloy's death, but the work done by the Center for Historical Reenactment under Gavin Provo, that entailed this mural of Dieter Baloy. And it's a fascinating, stunning piece of work to think about what it means to return an image to a space where violence was enacted. And so there's something about that account that you give about what the Center for Historical Reenactment performed in that space that provokes a sense of what it might mean to think history differently, to think it along other contours, to think it along contours that are not reducible to the grounds of the ideological or the merely political. And so I think that's a very important moment in this book. I mean, it really stirred and moved me to think again about what that moment when Dieter Baloy left Tananas and left us with his bass guitar, what that meant for our thinking and our historicization of the world. The second is, of course, Mongeni Buthelezi's work, and I'm now struck by how profoundly important his interventions are and his reworking of recycled plastic to create artworks. And besides its ecological and environmental importance, I think that what he gives us there is a sense of how we might think about something like repetition. And so he makes a very important comment about how he doesn't like to repeat the same form of art, you know, how he likes to change and shift and experiment with new media, new techniques. And I think that there's something very important in that statement. Because what he is gesturing towards is a sense of repetition with difference. In this country, we have become obsessed with thinking about repetition without the concept of difference. We have produced the concept of difference that is merely a context difference. We have not thought about what concepts of difference we might produce that might be different to a context difference. And I think what Buthelezi gives us in that beautiful, eloquent statement is an opportunity to think again about what it means to think differently. And so there's something profound in what the aesthetic does in that moment to how we might view and think about the world today. The third, of course, is Stompie Celebi's Meditation on Jazz and Miles Davis. And I thought that's so profound, because what we lack increasingly in this world is the possibility and opportunity for improvisation. And what Celebi has put on the table again is the importance of improvisation in thinking about the black world, in thinking about how one thinks one's way out of the predicaments that were given. And I think that there's something profound about the way in which jazz articulates with his artistic practice that again allows us to think about history along different contours by breathing life precisely into those domains that are overwhelmed by a sense of death. So, aesthetics is an important grid through which to rethink history. There is no escape from this. The state might not realize this. The property owners might not realize this, the developers might not realize this, but without aesthetics, we have no future. We are going to produce precisely the kind of sensibility that Verhoed wanted. Verhoed's PhD dissertation, as I say again and again, was titled The Blunting of Emotion. And what he wanted to do was to eviscerate all senses. That was the technique and the technology behind the madness that became about them. And so there's something about the aesthetic that proves absolutely critical for us to hold on to under very difficult circumstances. But aesthetics, as we know, is also a terrain of vulnerability. If one thinks about this book, there's a certain despair that sets in about the disappearance of the space, about the availability of the studio, the availability of access to this building, that makes us, there's a sense of mourning that sets in. History of sadness, if you like. But But notwithstanding that, I think what Kim has offered us is an opportunity to turn around that sadness, to think about it productively rather than as a sense, rather than as simply a state of despair. So I think what she's asking us to do is to think about the nomadic existence of art. That art in our times will have an itinerant character. That art practices and our artists will, in all measure, think about their lives and their ideas and their practices and their work in nomadic terms. That she is able to draw out the ways in which the struggle against apartheid for many artists also gave them an opportunity to perform art, to think about how you undermine the rituals of power through the artistic, through the performative. And so there are many instances in this book where one realizes that there's a trace, a long history here of how the performative is a way of responding, thinking differently, countering, even opposing the power that sets in, whether it's the rule of law or the rule of property. And finally, there is a sense in this book of art as a techne of giving, as a gift that cannot be reciprocated, as a gift that must be received in one form or the other. And the tragedy in this country, I suppose, is the refusal or the inability of people to receive the gift of art. And I think what this book reminds us is how much work we have to do in making clear what, how important the receipt of the gift is, particularly the gift of art. And so, finally, let me end by saying that this is a very important book. It's not only a beautifully crafted book, it is a book that's going to ask you to receive it with a certain amount of work. And that work relates to three broad terms. The one is to recapture a sense of freedom. And I want to recall here an essay that Walter Benjamin wrote in 1929 on the eve of the demise of the Weimar Republic, the horizon of fascism. Walter Benjamin wrote about the he wrote an essay called The Last Snapshot of the European Intelligentsia. And he bemoaned the fact that the European left had lost sense and sight of art, that it had lost sight of the idea of freedom, that what it had surrendered itself to was a big debate about governmentality and rule and power, but it had not taken hold of that very important thread that connected it to the 19th century. And that was the idea of freedom. And he suggests that the surrealists were the only ones that had a concept and access to the idea of freedom. We have an obligation here to reinvent the concept of freedom. That concept has been lost to us in this country, but also in the midst of the turmoil that this world is now facing, we need to think carefully about how we retrieve a concept of freedom through the arts. Secondly, I think this book asks us to rethink the idea of the everyday. The everyday is not as banal or ridiculous as it might seem. In fact, I think what this is approximating is Freud's idea of the everyday that he articulates in 1919, again after the First World War, when he steps out of his rooms into the streets of Vienna and he asks, what makes Vienna Vienna? Why is this revolting city? What does it have to offer? And it's contained in the essay, Psychopathology of Everyday Life. And he is deeply committed and concerned with the unconscious and how the unconscious might give us another way about thinking about the world. And so this book also is asking you to read between the lines and to read carefully through the kind of unconscious possibilities that might inhere in the subject. And then finally, I think what Kim is asking us to do is not to rest with the reductive sense of the imagination. The imagination is being bandied about by everybody from the Department of Arts and Culture right down to all sorts of political formations. It is not available to you as such. The imagination can only work if it takes account of something that is transcendental. And by that I mean a passage from sense to understanding. And what this book has given us is an opportunity to make sense of Johannesburg, but also to understand what it might mean, to think about its contours, its geographies, and its topographies differently. So thank you very much, Kim, for that very beautiful book.
Thank you so much. Commissioners and Laura, very interesting work, including running a new laboratory of the kinetic object, which is basically about things on the move. And this book is very much about that. It's about art on the move, how art is made and where it goes. It's about physical journeys, literal journeys, but also about conceptual journeys, about the kind of where does art take you in your mind, you know, take you someplace else. I'm going to draw on the exhibition upstairs, which Josh mentioned, called You and I, which is about collectivities, because the book corresponds to the idea in a number of different ways. And the first, Orbit Class, is of course a collective thing. It's kind of a common space. It belongs to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So this is really just part of a thread in a part of a larger conversation. What hopefully becomes evident is the meshwork of people and interrelationships and so on, and how meaning is created by this juxtaposition. It was a very collective effort to get the book out, so the writing part is very insular, but the research is very collaborative, and so is the actual making of a book. And I just want to say some thank yous around that. First of all, to the artists, I needed to stalk four artists in four studios, one on each floor. They had to let me into their practice and process at quite an awkward time because the building was being put up for sale. So it was an experiment. I didn't know where the research was going, and they had to say yes to that. So I can't underestimate, you know, they had to really take a leap of faith in the project. And those four artists were Mogheni Buthelezi, Tomi Talevi, Jackie McInnes, who's here, and Gordon Frau. There were other artists as well, lots of artists who make up that building, past and present. And I try and cite them and reference their work in different ways, both formally and informally. And also, of course, other tenants who weren't artists at all, lawyer, filmmakers, and so on, and they were part of the life of that building too, and I bring them in. In particular, the caretakers. The story begins and ends with the caretakers. Gibson Kamalo passed away last year, and Paolo Mandibuku. They really weave and stitch that building into the urban fabric, and I just want to acknowledge them too. And then Dee Fainter, who turned the building from a former factory space into an atelier, and she has a vision to do that in 2006, so just to reference her too. And then to actually make the book, you need people, you just need, I think, one or two people actually who believe in the project from the start. If you have that, you know, you can get to the end. And that person was Hector Peterson, our first voice of the project too, and he thought it was a good idea and encouraged me to pursue it and helped make it happen in a number of different ways. And also Graham Gott from GCRO, who then came in and provided resources to actually make the book, which is costs a lot of money to make a book. And he did it in a really free way, talking about freedom, no interference, and just letting the project do what it needed to do and being a kind of silent partner in that respect. And then Footfall, Terry Kirkens, my editor, who helped me shape that text, Bronwyn Lawful-Yun, who said yes to the project in the first place, and Carla Saunders, who helped turn that book into the artifact. I think she did a great job of that, you know, responding to the concept and then making it live in the book itself. I'll just give you one example. The actual paper, I don't know the technical term for that paper, but it's mostly recycled pulp, so it shows its flaws in the paper itself. You see all the threads and the dots and the specks and so on. And that's such a beautiful detail. It's the kind of thing that you write, you know. The book is about that. It's about messiness and practice and process. It's things that don't work out as you expect them to and so on. So it actually shows itself in the physical form of the book. I try to do that kind of focusing on detail with the writing as well, finding emblematic moments or statements to speak about something bigger. And then collectivity also comes up in the artist's response to uncertainty, because at heart that's also what the book is about. And what becomes evident is that they find ways to collaborate and find sort of collective responses to precarity. And there's some kind of key in that. It also asks, you know, raises structural issues that I don't deal with directly in the book. They invoke, but it's not trying to solve problems, it's trying to open up complexities. But I take those structural issues, I look at them in my academic work, and interestingly enough, the answer there is also around collectivity. It's just a different kind of understanding of what that is. And then tonight, the collective comes in again because there are a lot of people who helped make tonight happen. A4 Foundation, which has been thanked already, the speakers who folded their minds around the book in amazing ways and, you know, just helped to take it out into the world and provide access points for other people to come in. Hothouse Brewing, which provided our refreshments. And then yourselves, because it doesn't, you know, book doesn't live until it goes out into the world, and it needs to become part of a public narrative. And so, you know, an evening like tonight is part of the meaning making of the book itself. And then I just want to finally reference the work here. It's a performance that happened, that the artists convened one night to say goodbye to the building when the collective was kind of closing down. It's called Miles Rehearsal, so it references improvisation. It was very much about call and response and creating work as you go. And Stormy Talibi and Joel Carabo Elliott and other collaborators, and I just wanted to invoke that moment and put it into the room as part of the broader narrative. So thanks very much, everyone, for coming, and enjoy yourselves, have a glass of wine, and look at the exhibition. It's in the upper floors, and you know, you'll enjoy taking a look upstairs. Thank you.